For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're in a different kind of a chapter here tonight, Daniel chapter 5. You may wonder where the expression, the writings on the wall, comes from. It comes from Daniel chapter 5. And so we're going to talk about the writing on the wall here this evening, and we're looking at a very different kind of chapter. What we've been up to so far is really following Daniel's interaction with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. But chapter 5 begins a discussion of something that happens much later in essentially the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, a guy named Belshazzar. And we can date fairly specifically, in fact, when this whole scene in Daniel 5 takes place. The scene is basically one day in the life, and it happens to be a very amazing day in the life of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. It's significant because it's the last day of his life and the last day of the Babylonian Empire, and the date is September 539 BC. And the context is that Belshazzar's father, who is essentially a co-regent, a military leader, has been defeated by the combined forces of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so 50 miles outside of the city of Babylon, the army has been decimated. Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, has fled into the desert, never to be seen again. And the troops of Cyrus, the army's general of the Persian Empire, is moving toward the city of Babylon. And within a week's time of the defeat of the Babylonian army, the Babylonian Empire comes to an end. And what we're reading in Daniel chapter 5 is the very end of this empire. And it comes with some very troubling, in some ways, ironies that we want to work out here tonight. Let's take a look. We'll just start in the first few verses. It says, King Belshazzar gave a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he drank wine with them. And while Belshazzar was drinking the wine, he gave orders to bring in gold and silver cups that his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. And he wanted to drink from them with his nobles, his wives, and his concubines. Again, now just think about this. This is a little weird. His father has just lost the decisive battle against their enemies, the Persians. Their empire no longer exists. The only thing that's left of it is the city itself. And so here is Belshazzar having some big party with all of his cronies. And it says in verse 3 that they brought these gold cups taken from the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles and wives and concubines drank from them. And while they drank from them, they praised their idols made of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Okay. There's something seriously wrong here. What is this? This is what we call a flight from reality. Here is a man whose kingdom is coming to an end, who knows that he is the last king of this empire, that everything is about to change fundamentally for him and for everyone that he knows. And so in this dark moment, you have this bizarre and almost really incomprehensible thing going on. We have a party. And so just a couple, 1,000 of his more intimate friends get together, and they're just going to go at it and have fun together, maybe go out with a bang, I don't know. Here's what this is. This is what people refer to as hubris. Hubris is an exaggerated self-confidence that blinds people from their weakness. And Belshazzar absolutely had a lot of hubris. He is not dealing with reality. at this stage of the game. You know, think about it. This is the last night of the man's life. What would you do if this was the last night of your life? Well, I think you ought to just stick that in your pipe and smoke it for a while. It may become valuable later, but it's a poignant moment. And what we find is that this kind of pride that has become so part of Belshazzar's life is like all pride in the sense that it distorts reality to fit our desires. That's what pride does to people. We want things to be a certain way. And so we are just going to bend our understanding of reality until it looks like that sort of thing is possible for us. And, you know, sometimes this is addicted. People know all about this. Well, actually, they don't know enough about this. They need to be told about this. That there's a kind of a magical thinking that goes on. Well, you know, yeah, I've got this problem, but it's under control. Been there, done that. That's a problem. Some of us have a very aristocratic interest in our material well-being on a bourgeois salary that we try to fit into that bigger-than-life picture of what we can do. And we'll find, in fact, people promising us that we can, in fact, be this person that we desire to be, only to realize, my God, I'm so far in over my head, I can't make it anymore. And so we're aware of this fact that all of us, we're not so different from Belshazzar. We are like him in the sense that we are prideful people, that there is a tendency for us to distort reality to fit our desires. And how he does, it's pretty interesting. First, there's this willful refusal to face the facts. The fact is that the largest army ever amassed in human history has defeated his army and is on the way. They are less than 50 miles from his city. And they're not coming to make peace. Okay? Well, Belshazzar knows that. And yet, incomprehensibly, he just cannot bring himself to face, what do I do with this? You know, if he was really understanding it, his behavior would be different. He'd go out there and meet Cyrus the Persian and say, spare my people, please, or something. But no, he is so caught up in himself, he can't even comprehend that this kind of thing is actually happening to him. He's blinded by privilege and blinded by his status. I remember many years ago when the former president of Egypt was reviewing his troops, as presidents are wont to do. And here is Anwar Sadat sitting there watching his army go by when one of his soldiers lowers his gun and begins shooting people in the VIP booth. Well, Sadat's like, how dare you? And he stands up as though he's, what's he going to do? You know, it's like the invulnerable Anwar Sadat demands that you cease now. Well, he was shot through the chest and died immediately. He could not understand the thought that someone would not bow to his will. And so it is that we are blinded, and certainly Belshazzar was blinded by his privilege and by his place. We call the group of people that he was hanging with, his little cronies, their own little subculture of groupthink. We tend to surround ourselves by people who reinforce each other's self-deceptions. So if you've got particular kinds of problems in your life or attitudes that are maybe unhealthy for you, what you will find is like some kind of a magnet, unintelligible to anyone but you. You just find those people who are like you in that way. Are you like that? I can pick a dopehead out of a crowd any time because I understand that.
And there's a vision that I had, but other people have different kinds of things that they're drawn to. And we tend to surround ourselves with people who are like us. They think like us. We've got these subtle things that draw us to each other. Why? Because we really are kind of being co-belligerents in one another's fleeing from reality. That's what groupthink is. Surround yourself with people who think just like you, and pretty soon you're going to be thinking that whatever you guys are about, which you all agree on, is what is. That's what's normal. That's what's real. And all social groupings tend to have that pattern going on. And so it's very important that we realize the extremely significant extent to which we can be self-deceived. Third is that we see here Belshazzar clinging to these gods, clinging to these idols, which to them, that meant something. That was significant. Babylon was a city given to the god Marduk. And Marduk was viewed by them as, you know, the greatest god there ever was. And the proof of that was that Marduk was able to use the Babylonian people to kick every other people's butt for, you know, hundreds of years. And so here's Belshazzar, and he's like, look, you know, there is no greater God than ours. And so it's incomprehensible to me that we would be defeated by any other army at all. And as a consequence, then, he would look out over the walls that were built and think, we've got the right God on our side. The city of Babylon was amazing. It was a completely enclosed walled city. Its walls were 20 to 30 feet thick, 80 feet high. Okay, that's pretty thick. Okay, especially when people are throwing stones and arrows at you, right? And so in the ancient world, of course, you'd have to lay a city like this under siege for many years. You're essentially starving people out, but not Babylon. Oh, no. Babylon actually had one of the little out, whatever it's called, things, estuaries. Part of the Euphrates River went right through the city. This is what I'm trying to say. Okay? And so they had an unlimited water source. They were able to do agricultural products, you know. They had warehouses of food for many years to come. And so they're sitting pretty. And so Belshazzar is able to look at that and think, well, at least I've got my city, the invulnerable Babylon. Yeah. One problem with that, however. It's true. These walls were invulnerable. But all Cyrus had to do, the Persian king who defeated his dad in the battle, was to dam up that part of the river, which he did do. And a week later, after having dammed it up, literally walk right into the city. Walls intact, but we're in. And that is how Babylon fell. And Belshazzar, in all of his pride, simply could not conceive of the possibility that something like this could happen. He was totally, totally self-deceived. Well, it gets more interesting. In verse 5, it says, suddenly they, that is the guys gathered for the party, they saw the fingers of a human hand writing on the plaster wall of the king's palace near the lampstand. I tried to find some clip art that would illustrate that. I just couldn't quite get it. The king himself saw the hand as it wrote. This is really weird. And his face turned pale with fright. His knees knocked together in fear, and his legs gave way beneath him. The king said to his wise men, the one who can read and interpret this message will receive a purple robe and a gold chain and will become the third highest ruler in the kingdom.
Well, we've seen this kind of thing before, haven't we? We've been reading Daniel, and there's a lot of weird visions and stuff that kings can't figure out. And so what do? They go to their wise men, and what happens with the wise men? They can't figure it out either. So what happens? Well, Daniel, now he's about 80 years old and has no doubt been in retirement for some time, comes to the memory of one of Belshazzar's wives. And he says, hey, there's this Jewish guy, Daniel, and he was able to give interpretation to the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. So let's bring him in. And so sure enough, they bring Daniel in. And it says in verse 25, Daniel says, here's the message. On the plaster, it reads, many, many tekel parson, which is probably Syriac. Maybe it's a very early Arabic. No one knows exactly what it is, but it's probably that. It's a language that was known at the time. It's not just some blather. And he says, and this is the meaning of the words. Mene means numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign and has brought it to an end. Hello. Tekel means weighed. You have been weighed on the balances and have been found wanting. Parson means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And then it says, that very night, Belshazzar, king of Babylon, was killed. Well, that's a really sorry way to go, isn't it? This great man with great wealth and great power and great influence and great opportunity is murdered this night. The Medo-Persian Empire takes over and Babylon ceases to exist. Let's think about the writing on the wall. What does it mean? First, your days are numbered. Now, that would be a very intimidating thing to say to the most powerful person in the world at that time. Your days are numbered, especially given they sort of viewed themselves sort of as a semi-divine person to begin with. You just don't say those kinds of things. And yet, Daniel, of course, did, because he understands who the true king is. Your days, he says, are numbered. Well, here's the thing, folks. The writing on the wall is not just for Belshazzar. The writing on the wall applies to us all. Everything that God had inspired written on the wall and which Daniel interpreted to the king applies in a very direct way to us as well. Your days are numbered. Now, hopefully, I'm hoping that it will last a little longer than Belshazzar's for you. But there's no guarantee there, is there? We don't know how many days we are allotted, but we do know that our days are numbered. And so we come to a principle of wisdom. This comes from our partners in Asia, World Team. They have this little motto, which is always stuck in my mind, begin with the end in mind. I've always thought that made a lot of sense. Count your days. Know that your days are numbered. Know that there is an end point, and begin with that end in mind. Which says essentially, look, what does it mean to live the life? What happens at the end? And how we answer that question becomes very important in terms of how do I live my life in the present? So I count my days. I begin with the end in mind. For me, I think the end is just like, fertilizer or whatever. Well, that's very instructive. That's very important. If all you have is whatever number of years you have on this earth, then that suggests very much how you live your life in the present, does it not? If you have 75 years, what's the average now? I think it's up over 80 for Americans. Maybe you'll be one of those lucky ones to hit the mean age. But if that's it, then you're done, and there's no memory, there's no you, and all is lost from your perspective, then you have to ask this question, does anything I do matter at all? Does it make any
difference. Just, you know, even if I did something noble, like I tried to make it a little bit nicer in this world for someone else, who cares? Because they are heading for the very same fate that you are. The very same. And so it's important for us to understand, to have an answer to this question, what is the end? You know, most people in our culture are so afraid of this question that you cannot even ask it. Most people in our culture live as though the future is going to be more or less an ongoing extension of the past. And so for some, that kind of sucks, and they're trying to make it better. For others, they like it just the way there is, the way it is, and they don't want anything to change. But the thought that I would have to really sit down and in a definitive way come to terms with what happens when my body quits is something that is extremely threatening to people, and they don't want to ask that question. There is a fear here that is preventing people from really getting at, in an honest way, this question. But the writing's on the wall, folks. The writing's on the wall. Your days are numbered. And where it will be very important then for us to confront our mortality. What's your answer for what happens when you die? How confident are you in that answer? Those are great questions. Those are important questions. And I want to tell you here tonight, those are answerable questions. Those are answerable questions. And the Bible speaks with great clarity on this point. That's why there is this thing called the Bible, because it is a laying out of God about what is wrong with humanity, why we have to deal with mortality at all. It's because of our alienation from Him, our revolt against His rulership in our lives. And that has put us, it's broken the relationship, it's put us at a distance, and it makes us stand under His judgment. That's the human condition. That's why we're afraid to look at that. Intrinsically, we know that that is so. But the story of the Scripture is that God has an answer for that. It's the grace of God. It's God taking the initiative to meet us at this hopeless place where we don't have the resources, the answers within ourselves to deal with our own fundamental problem. And through Jesus Christ has provided for us the solution to this problem. Confront your mortality. What is a fool? A fool is a person who believes with all his heart something that he should know better is false. That's what a fool is. It's not someone who's, you know, mentally challenged or something like that. It's a moral term. It's about a person who suppresses what they know so that they can go on believing a fiction that, while convenient for them, ends up in their destruction. And Jesus speaks of such a fool in Luke chapter 12, starting in verse 15, where he says, "Not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." And it says, he went on and he told his disciples a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' He said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have so many goods laid up for so many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Thou fool,'" that's the King James way of putting it, "'thou fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? And so is a man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" And that's a fool. And folks, we live in a foolish culture. We live in a culture that is all about amassing things in the moment without any real thought about what is the end game anyway. So it is as though we live in a culture that more or less personifies what this person is. That's foolish. He's not saying that wealth is intrinsically bad or anything like that. That's not the point. The point is that this is where this man's head was at. This is what blinded him from looking at these important questions. The writing on the wall, he could not see because he was so distracted by these things that he had. And it is possible to distract yourself to death. And that's what people are doing all around us, just distracting themselves to death. The Bible presents a picture of a living hope, not self-deceived wishful thinking, not this is the way I would really like for it to be, this is my reality, what about yours, or just not even thinking in real terms. I like the way one philosopher put it years ago. He said, which is it better, to be a dissatisfied Socrates or a satisfied pig? What he meant by that is, look, I can't figure out the answers on my own. I need revelation and don't have it. So why even worry about the life of the mind? Because we're not going to find our answers there. So let's just do the only thing that we can do, and that is to be a satisfied pig. Lower our expectations. Just live for the moment, live for now, because that's all we really have. And the Bible's like, okay, yeah, that is man's perspective. That those are the real options there. But we have an opportunity to experience the living hope of God Himself, who has chosen to disclose Himself to us, who has made it possible for us to know Him and to come into relationship with Him. That's a living, eyes open, reasonable hope that God calls us to. So, the writing on the wall, your days are numbered, he says. Second, he says, you've been weighed and been found wanting. And oh my gosh, what a terrible thing to hear. Here's my assessment of your life. You don't measure up. Here's the assessment of my life. There's no weight, no substance to you. Man, this is the ultimate diss by God. You don't measure up. You've been found wanting. Wow. What is he saying? He's saying, folks, the writing's on the wall. Number your days and realize that we are accountable to God. And God is calling Belshazzar into account that very night. The problem that we have here, the problem that Belshazzar had, was not an intellectual problem, an inability to comprehend this reality. Not so. In fact, it says in verses 22 and 23, when Daniel confronts Belshazzar, he says, you know, yet you, Nebuchadnezzar's son, he says, actually it's grandson, but that's just the convention of the language at the time, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this, all this stuff that we talked about last time, about how God delivered Nebuchadnezzar over to insanity until he was willing to cry uncle and to acknowledge the sovereignty of God. He says, Belshazzar, you knew all of this, but you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. You knew. And it'd be hard to keep something like that a secret. You know, what's the gossip around the palace? Oh, yeah, old Nebo's gone nuts again. He's out there eating grass like a cow. You know, everybody knew this. Belshazzar knew this. And he knew why. And he knew because why? Because Nebuchadnezzar himself, as we learned last week, made a public proclamation of why he had been driven to this insane place, and that there is one God who is ruler over heaven. An act of extraordinary humility. And Belshazzar was witness to that. He knew that. And he's accountable, Daniel says. He's accountable for that. What are you accountable to God for? What has he revealed of himself to you? Through his word. Through the legacy of his work in your life. What you see him doing in the lives of other people. We're accountable because we have seen God at work. Paul puts it like this in the New Testament. He says, God's judgment is revealed. His accountability comes against everyone, he says, who suppresses the truth. Because what is known about God is evident within them, for God has made it evident to them through what has been made so that they are without excuse. What Paul is saying here in the New Testament is that there is no such thing at the end of the day truly of a consistent atheist. He says the knowledge of God is evident within. We realize that there is something special about human beings, the dignity that all human beings have. We understand by reflection on our own internal lives that there are such things as good and bad and right and wrong and just and unjust. And we know that these things then must speak of a person who embodies real value, not just nature, this cause and effect material orb that we are spinning through space on, but a real God in whose image we are. And he says every human being knows that. And the testimony of history is that every culture believes that this is the case. What's evident within cries out for a God. What is evident through what has been made, the complexity of nature, the awareness that this is not just some sort of biological accident, that the complexity, the order, all these things are such that it cries out just to any observer, there's got to be a mind behind this. That's why Einstein said, God doesn't play dice with the universe. That's why the consensus of astronomers today, the overwhelming consensus of astronomers today, hold there was a beginning to the universe and no natural way to explain how that could have happened. Supernatural. We're accountable to God. And yet we've got this God allergy, don't we? Daniel says to Belshazzar, the God in whose hand are your life and your destiny, you've not glorified. You've known that you're accountable to God, but you take your life into your own hands as though it were your life, and your destiny into your own hands as though it were yours, and you've not attributed to the God who made you the things that he's given to you. And there's something really dark about that, and sinister about that, and gross about that. And it's this little, pathetic little secret that human beings, alienated from God, hang on to. And so, therefore, when we enter into conversation about God, it's never neutral, is it? It's never neutral. It's always awkward. It's always embarrassing. It's always weird because we know that it's opening up the door to this room that we've been trying not to go into maybe our whole lives. The God allergy. Paul puts it like this. He says, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him. And as a consequence, they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. What's the central problem? It's not an intellectual problem. It's a moral problem. It's a spiritual problem. It's we've got an aversion to God because acknowledging God for who he is means that I have to humble myself. It means I not only have to recognize that God is the ultimate authority in the universe, but that he's my authority also. That God created the universe by his power and on the authority of Colossians chapter 1 for himself. He created you to have relationship with him. That's why he created you. He has intense interest in you. And he wants you to yield to him so that you can have a personal relationship with him instead of keeping him at this icy distance. And that's why then, as insistent as the Bible is that this is the problem that humanity has, it is equally insistent that God himself has provided the solution to this problem. That the goodness of God, the mercy of God, the grace of God is more than sufficient to deal with the dark-heartedness of human beings who are living in alienation from him. And so Paul can say to his friend Timothy, he says, the statement is trustworthy. He says, Christ came into the world to save sinners, among whom I am foremost of all. You know, Paul came to that place where he realized I was suppressing the very things that God was trying to use as evidence to show me his reality. He gave me the entire Old Testament, and all I did was mell out over the 613 rules that's going to make me more acceptable to him if I keep them. Without even really thinking about what did God say he was going to do in history through his Messiah. And then, insulted as I was by sinful people who seemed to say that they had something real going with God, I made sure that they were killed. So he says, yeah, I'm a pretty bad guy, having both misrepresented God and killed people who God loves. And so he says, just, you know, no one is beyond the pale of God's love, God's mercy. And he is reaching out to us. He's reaching out to you even here tonight. And he's saying, look, I'm as merciful as the most sinful of people. And I love you. And I have provided the way for you to be forgiven, to come into relationship with me, to put aside the fact that you don't measure up. That's put that totally out of the way. All I'm asking you to do is to say, by faith, I need your mercy, God, and I'm prepared to accept the offer of forgiveness in Christ. That's all God is asking us to do. Well, you say, that's just too easy. That's just way too easy. Oh, really? Why haven't you done it yet? It's not so easy because it's a confrontation with your pride. Because it means that I have to trust resources outside of me. That's what that's about. And lastly, he says, the last thing written on the wall, your kingdom goes to somebody else. Well, as all kingdoms do. Your kingdom, humble though it may be, is not for yours to keep forever. And so we need to think in terms of legacy here. And we ask this question about accomplishment, which I think this is kind of an important area to end on and get some discussion going about. It is true that our days are numbered. It is true that we are accountable to God. And it is also true that all that we have is passed on to, you know, somebody else. And we don't just mean necessarily our material things, but also, you know, when we think about what is the legacy of our life, we want to think about what did I really accomplish here in this life? How many of you have a 401k? Just a few of you. No way, man. I know that's not true. The rest of you just won't admit it. You're probably hiding it somewhere. Swiss bank account or something.
Now, I'm going to suggest that your retirement is of interest to you and you plan it. Right? You plan it. You think about it. You get together and you talk about how much money are we going to set aside and what's this all going to look like, you know, what's your number, as the commercial says. And we think about that kind of stuff. We're very deliberate about that kind of thing. That's the way we are. And that's a good thing. I'm not disparaging that in any way. But what I want to say is, how come it is that we are deliberate and calculating about things like our retirements, our financial life, when as Christians we are on board with the thought that there are things vastly more important than that? Things about which we do very little calculation and think very rarely of accomplishment. I think that's weird. And what I think is, you know, here's the question for you. What would an observer of your life, I choose my words carefully. I'm not talking about someone who listens in on what you say. I'm talking about an observer of what you do. What would an observer say about your life and about your spiritual life? Are you pious or are you purposeful? By pious, I mean that you're a nice fella, that you're known to be basically a nice fella, that people feel ambiguously uncomfortable cussing around you, things like that, that you're basically a religious person, a nice person, a trustworthy person. You're pious. Well, you know, that's okay. That's all right. But that's not the same thing as being purposeful. Being purposeful, it means setting goals. It means saying, I'm going to be about this thing. I want to accomplish something that matters, and I'm going to set out to establish a way of living which at the end of my life, I can look back and I can say, man, I accomplished this thing that was important. Important to me, important to God. And here I think many of us as Christians are really not living a biblical life. We're kind of rolling in from one week to the next, kind of herding in and herding out of our interactions with our Christian brothers and sisters. We're not asking ourselves the question, what is my role here? What's my purpose in this community? We're not asking ourselves, you know, God has given me incredible resources. He's given me training. He's given me talent. How can I use these things tangibly, specifically, to uniquely draw people's attention to Him? I say that's what I value. I recognize the importance of being intentional, of being a planner. Why isn't this a part of that planning also? Well, you say, well, because spiritual things are like, that's different. Spiritual things are like, you know, for me. Well, in a way they are for you. God loves you. But He loves you and He entrusts you with your moment in time, with the gifts that He's been given, which you've been given, so that you can seize the moment and you can enter into the thing that really matters, what God is doing in the world. And here I just think there's a lot of distraction. There's a lot of kind of like Belshazzar, you know. We get caught up in our stuff. We lose that perspective. We can't see the writing on the wall when it's there. And we need these reminders from the Word of God. You're not going to take it with you. Your kingdom is going to go to another. You probably are not going to care in your last days or hours how many overtime hours you were willing to put in, or how many extra steps up the ladder you made, or how many fish you caught, or
whatever it is. Whatever it is, in my case, how many books I've purchased. Okay. The question is, do I have the same intentionality with the things of God that I do in every other area of my life that means something to me? And so, think about that. Because that's a big deal. That's your legacy. That's what you pass on to other people. I'm really glad. And so, you know, it's not like what I'm not talking about here, just to draw things to a conclusion, what I'm not talking about here is, you know, making sure that my will really is equally distributing all my things to all the people that I love or something like that, something that you do kind of at the end. I'm talking about something here that you are building in to the lives of people around you in intentional ways and over a period of time so that the things that God has breathed into you, the things that reflect His goodness and His mercy and all of these things, then they begin to be instilled in the lives of other people. That is what I'm talking about as a legacy. It's very intentional, it's relational, and it's something that occurs over time. We're very concerned about this as parents, aren't we? Very concerned about this. We want our kids to have a good legacy of us as being their parents. My dad gave me some wonderful things. He gave me a love of music. He gave me a love of hard work. There are things that I am who I am because, regardless of his failings, he valued those things and he instilled those in me. And how much more then for us here tonight as Christian parents, as Christian neighbors, as Christian work associates, how much more intentional we can be about communicating the love and the mercy, the goodness of God to other people in very tangible ways. That is our legacy. Here's the question I'd like to discuss with you tonight. What great gift do you want to impart to those that you love? Have you ever just sat back and asked yourself that question? So you're imparting all the time, right? You have to, because we all influence the people around us. Even if it's a dead weight, it's influence. What great gift do you want to impart to the people that you love? And how do you impart it to them? Your kingdom is going to be passed to another.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.